He made a soft sound before he collapsed. The palmist screamed. Pliny assessed the tasser's form. When she looked up at us, her eyes were gas flame blue. I swerved my gaze away from them. Any other questions? The palmist clapped a hand over her mouth. We were herded into a small room, wet walls and floor, dark as a crypt. Pliny locked us in and left. For a minute, nobody dared speak. The palmist heaved out sobs, close to hysteria. Most of the others were still too weak to talk. I sat down in a corner, out of the way. Beneath my sleeves, my skin was stippled with goose flesh.
"Is it still the tower?"
said an ogre.
"It looks like the tower."
"Shut up," someone said. "Just shut up." Someone started praying to the zeitgeist of all things. Like that would help. I rested my chin on my knees. I didn't want to know what they would do to us. I didn't know how strong I'd be if they put me on the waterboard. I'd heard my father talk about it. How they only let you breathe for a few seconds at a time. He said it wasn't torture. It was therapy. A seer sat down beside me. He was bald and broad-shouldered. I couldn't see much of him in the gloom, but I could see his large, intensely dark eyes. He extended a hand. "Julian." He didn't seem afraid. Just quiet.
"Paige," I said.
Best not to use full names. I cleared my dry throat. "What's your cohort?"
4th, 6th.
"First 4. That's the Whitebinder's territory," I nodded.
"Which part?"
"Soho," I said. If I said I was in Dials, he'd know I must be one of Jackson's nearest and dearest.
"I envy you.
I'd love to have lived central."
"Why?"
"Syndicate's strong there. My section doesn't see much action." He kept his voice low.
"Did you give them a reason to arrest you?"
"Killed an underguard." My throat ached.
"You?"
"Minor disagreement with the Vigile. Long story short, the Vigile is no longer with us."
"But you're a seer."
Most Voyans regarded seers, a class of soothsayer, with disdain. Like all soothsayers, they communed with spirits through objects. In a seer's case, anything reflective. Jax hated soothsayers with a passion.
"Shitsayers, Dolly, call them shitsayers."
"And ogres, come to think of it." Julian seemed to read these thoughts.
"You don't think C is capable of murder?"
"Not with spirits. You couldn't control a big enough spool."
"You do know your Voyance."
He rubbed his arms. "You're right. I shot him. Didn't stop them arresting me." I didn't reply. Icy water dripped from the ceiling onto my hair and ran down my nose. Most of the other prisoners were silent. One boy was rocking back and forth on his heels.
"You have a strange aura."
Jillian looked at me.
"I can't work out what you are."
"I'd say oracle, but..."
"But?"
"I haven't heard of a woman being an oracle in a long time.
I don't think you're a Sybil."
"I'm an occultomancer."
"What'd you do, stab someone with a needle?
Something like that?" There was a crash from outside, and an awful scream. Everyone stopped talking.
"That's a berserker."
The voice was male, afraid.
"They're not going to put a berserker in here, are they?"
"There's no such thing as a berserker," I said.
"Have you not read on the merits?"
"Yes, it's a hypothetical type." He didn't look relieved. The thought of the pamphlet made me colder than ever. It could be anywhere, in anyone's hands. A first edition of the most seditious pamphlet in the Citadel, covered in fresh notes and contact details. I could never have got such a thing without knowing the writer.
"They're going to torture us again."
The whisperer was cradling her broken arm.
"They want something. They wouldn't have just let us out."
"Out of where?" I said.
"The tower, idiot. Where we've all been for the last 2 years.
"Two." There was a half-hysterical laugh from the corner. "Trying 9 years. Another laugh, a giggle.
9 years.
From what we knew, detainees were given 2 choices. Join the NVD or be executed.
There was no need to store people. Why nine? I said. There was no answer from the corner. After a minute, Gillian spoke up. Anyone else wonder why we're not dead? They killed everyone else. A new voice. I was there for months. The other voyants in my wing all got the noose. Pause. We've been picked for something.
Sizes,
somebody whispered. We're going to be lab rats, aren't we? The doctors want to cut us up. This isn't Sizers, I said. There was a long silence, broken only by the bitter tears of the palmist. She couldn't seem to stop. Finally, Carl addressed the whisperer.
You said they must want something, Hissa. What could they want?
Anything. Our sight.
They can't take our sight, I said.
Please, you're not even sighted. They won't want disabled voyants. I resisted the urge to break her other arm.
What did she do to the Tassa?
The palmist was shaking.
His eyes. She didn't even move.
Well, I thought we'd be killed for sure,
Carl said, as if he couldn't imagine why the rest of us were so worried. His voice was less hoarse.
I'd take anything over the noose, wouldn't you?
We might still get the noose, I said. He fell silent. Another boy, so pale it looked as if the flux had burned the blood out of his veins, was beginning to hyperventilate. Freckles dusted his nose. I hadn't noticed him before. He had no trace of an aura.
What is this place?
He could hardly get the words out.
Who are you people?
Gillian glanced at him.
You're Amarotic, he said. Why have they taken you?
Amarotic?
Probably a mistake.
The oracle seemed bored.
They'll kill him all the same. Tough luck, kid.
The boy looked as though he might faint. He leapt to his feet and yanked at the bars.
I'm not meant to be here. I want to go home. I'm not unnatural. I'm not.
He was almost in tears.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry about the stone.
I clapped a hand over his mouth. Stop it. A few of the others swore at him.
You want her to reef you too?
He was trembling. I guessed he was about 15, but a weak 15. I was forcefully reminded of a different time, a time when I was frightened and alone.
What's your name?
I tried to sound gentle.
Seb. Seb Pierce.
He crossed his arms, trying to make himself smaller.
Are you all unnaturals?
Yeah, and we'll do unnatural things to your internal organs if you don't shut your rotten trap.
A voice sneered. Seb cringed.
No, we won't, I said.
I'm Paige. This is Gillian. Gillian just nodded. It looked like it was my job to make small talk with the Amarotic. Where are you from, Seb? I said.
Third cohort.
The ring, Gillian said. Nice. Seb looked away. His lips shook with cold. No doubt he thought we'd chop him up and bathe in his blood in an occult frenzy. The ring was where I'd gone to secondary school, a street name for third cohort. Tell us what happened, I said. He glanced at the others. I couldn't find it in myself to blame him for his fear. He'd been told from the second he could talk that clairvoyants were the source of all the world's evils, and here he was in prison with them. One of the sixth formers planted contraband in my satchel, he said. Probably a shoe stone, the most common newman on the black market. The schoolmaster saw me trying to give it back to them in class. He thought I'd got it from one of those beggar types. They called his school vigils to check me. Definitely a Saiyan kid. If his school had its own gillies, he must be from an astronomically rich family. It took hours to convince them I'd been framed. I took a shortcut home. Seb swallowed. There were two men in red on the corner. I tried to walk past them, but they heard me. They wore masks. I don't know why, but I ran. I was scared. Then I had a gunshot, and then I think I must have fainted. And then I was sick. I wondered about the effects of flux on amarotics. It made sense that the physical symptoms would appear. Vomiting, thirst, inexplicable terror. but not phantasmagoria. That's awful, I said. I'm sure this is all a terrible mistake. And I was sure. There was no way a well-bred, amorotic kid like Seb should be here. Seb looked encouraged. Then they'll let me go home.
No,
Julian said. My ears pricked. Footsteps.
Pliny was back.
She pulled open the door, grabbed the nearest prisoner and hauled him to his feet with one hand.
Follow me. Remember the rules.
We left the building through a set of double doors, the palmist guided by the whisperer. The frigid air hit every inch of exposed skin. I started when we came to the gallows. Maybe this was the tower. But Pliny walked past it. I had no idea what she'd done to the tasser, or what the scream had been, but I wasn't about to ask. Head down, eyes open. That would be my rule here too. She led us through deserted streets, illuminated by gaslight and wet after a night of heavy rain. Julian fell into step behind me. As we walked, the buildings grew larger, but they weren't skyscrapers. They were nowhere near that scale. No metal framework, no electric light. These buildings were old and unfamiliar, built when aesthetic tastes were different. Stone walls, wooden doors, leaded windows glazed with deep red and amethyst. When we rounded the last corner, we were greeted by a sight I would never forget. The street that stretched in front of us was oddly wide. There wasn't a car in sight, just a long line of ramshackle dwellings, winding drunkenly from one end to the other. Plywood walls propped up slats of corrugated metal. On either side of this little town were larger buildings. They had heavy wooden doors, high windows, and crenellation, like the castles of Victoria's days. They reminded me so much of the tower that I had to look away. Several feet from the nearest hut, a group of svelte figures stood in an open-air stage. Candles had been placed all around them, illuminating their masked faces. A violin sang below the boards. Buoyant music. The sort only a whisperer could perform. Looking up at them was a large audience. Every member of that audience wore a red tunic and a black gilet. As if they'd been awaiting our arrival, the figures began to dance. They were all clairvoyant. In fact, everyone here was clairvoyant. The dancers, the spectators, everyone. Never in my life had I seen so many voyants in one place, standing peacefully together. There must have been 100 observers clustered around the stage. This was no secret meeting in an underground tunnel. This wasn't Hector's brutal syndicate. This was different. When Seb reached for my hand, I didn't shake him off. The show went on for a few minutes. Not all of the spectators were paying attention. Some were talking among themselves, others jeering at the stage. I was sure I heard someone say cowards. After the dance, a girl in a black leotard stepped out onto a higher platform. Her dark hair was slicked back into a bun, and her mask was gold and winged. She stood there for a moment, still as glass. Then she jumped from the platform and seized two long red drapes that had been dropped from the rigging. Weaving her legs and arms around them, she climbed up 20 feet before unraveling into a pose. She earned a smattering of applause from the audience. My brain was still drug-addled. Was this some kind of voyant cult? I'd heard of stranger things. I forced myself to study the street. One thing was certain. This wasn't Silo. There was no sign of Cyan's presence at all. Big old buildings, public performances, gas lamps and a cobbled street. It was like we'd rewound time. I knew exactly where I was. Everyone had heard about the lost city of Oxford. It was part of the Cyan school curriculum. Fires had destroyed the university in the autumn of 1859. What remained was classified as a Type A restricted sector. No one was allowed to set foot there for fear of some indefinable contamination. Cyan had just wiped it from the maps. I read in Jackson's records that an intrepid journalist from The Roaring Boy had tried to drive there in 2036, threatening to write an exposé, but his car was driven off the road by snipers,
never to be seen again. The roaring boy, a penny paper, disappeared just as quickly. It had tried far too often to uncover Sion's secrets. Pleione turned to look at us. The darkness made it hard to see her face, but her eyes still burned. "It is unseemly to stare," she said. "You do not want to be late for the oration." Yet we couldn't help but stare at the dance. We followed her, but she couldn't stop us looking. We trooped after Pleione until we reached a pair of enormous wrought iron gates. They were unlocked by two men, both of whom resembled our guide. Same eyes, same satin skin, same auras. Pleione sailed right past them. Seb was starting to go green. I kept hold of his hand as we walked through the grounds of the building. This Amarotic should mean nothing to me, but he seemed too vulnerable to be left alone. The palmist was in tears. Only the oracle, picking at his knuckles, seemed fearless. As we walked, we were joined by several other groups of white-clad newcomers. Most of them looked frightened, but a few seemed exhilarated. My group drew closer together as we joined the ranks. We were being herded. We spilled into a long and lofty room. Olive-green shelves stretched from the floor to the ceiling, packed with beautiful old books. 11 stained glass windows lined one wall. The decor was classical, with a dressed stone floor inlaid in a diagonal pattern. The captives jostled into lines. I stood between Julian and Seb, my senses on red alert. Julian was tense too. His eyes moved from one white-clad captive to another, sizing them up. It was a real melting pot. A cross-section of voyants, from augurs and soothsayers to mediums and censors. Pleione had left us. Now she stood on a plinth with what I guessed were 8 of her fellow Rafaid creatures. My sixth sense quaked. Once we were assembled, a deathly hush swept over the room. A single woman stepped forward, and then she began to speak. Chapter 4. A Lecture Upon the Shadow. Welcome to Sheol 1. The speaker was about 6.5 feet tall. Her features were perfectly symmetrical. A long, straight nose, high cheekbones, deep-set eyes fixed in her face. The candlelight ran through her hair and across her burnished skin. She wore black like the others, but her sleeves and sides were slashed with gold. "I am Nashira Saugus." Her voice was cool and low-pitched. "I am the blood sovereign of the race of Rafaim."
"Is this a joke?" someone whispered.
"Shh," hissed another. "First of all, I must apologize for the harrowing start to your time here, especially if you were housed first in the tower. The vast majority of clairvoyants are under the impression that they are going to be executed when they are summoned to our fold. We use Fluxion 14 to ensure their transmission to Sheol 1 is safe and straightforward. After being sedated, you were placed on a train and taken to a detainment facility, where you were monitored. Your clothing and belongings have been confiscated." As I listened, I examined the woman, looking into the ether. Her aura was unlike anything I'd ever sensed before. I wished I could see it. It was as if she'd taken several different types of aura and forged them all into one strange field of energy. There was something else, too. A cold edge. Most auras gave off a soft, warm signal, like I'd walked past a space heater. But this one gave me deep chills. "I understand that you were surprised to see this city. You may know it as Oxford. Its existence was disavowed by your government 2 centuries ago, before any of you were born. It was supposedly quarantined after an outbreak of fire. This was a lie. It was closed off so we, the Rafaim, could make it our home. We arrived 2 centuries ago in 1859. Your world had reached what we called the ethereal threshold." She assessed our faces. "The majority of you are clairvoyant. You understand that sentient spirits exist all around us, too cowardly or stubborn to meet their final death in the heart of the ether. You can commune with them, and in return they will guide and protect you. But that connection has a price. When the corporeal world becomes overpopulated with drifting spirits, they cause deep rifts in the ether. When these rifts become too wide, the ethereal threshold breaks. When Earth broke its threshold, it became exposed to a higher dimension called Netherworld, where we reside. Now we have come here. Nishira leveled her gaze on my line of prisoners. You humans have made many mistakes. You packed your fertile earth with corpses, burdened it with drifting spirits. Now it belongs to the Rephaim. I looked at Julian and saw my exact fear mirrored in his eyes. This woman had to be insane. Silence filled the room. Nishira Sargas had our attention. My people, the Rephaim, are all clairvoyant. There are no Amarotics among us. Since the rift between our worlds occurred, we have been forced to share the Netherworld with a parasitic race called the Amim. They are mindless bestial creatures with a taste for human flesh. If not for us, they would have come here from beyond the threshold. They would have come for you. Mad. She was mad. You were all detained by humans in our employ. They are called Red Jackets. Nishira indicated a line of men and women all clad in scarlet at the back of the library. Since our arrival, we have taken many clairvoyant humans under our wing. In exchange for protection, we train you to destroy the Amim, to protect the natural population as part of a penal battalion. This city acts as a beacon to the creatures, drawing them away from the rest of the corporeal world. When they breach its walls, Red Jackets are summoned to destroy them. Such breaches are announced by a siren. There is a high risk of mutilation. There is also, I thought, a high risk that this is all in my head. We offer you this fate as an alternative to what Sion would offer. Death by hanging or asphyxiation. Or, as some of you have already experienced, a long, dark sentence in the tower. In the row behind me, one girl began to whimper. She was shushed by the people on either side of her. Of course, we do not have to work together. Nishira paced along the front row. When we came to this world, we found it vulnerable. Only a fraction of you are clairvoyant, and still less have marginally useful abilities. We might have let the Amim turn on you. We would have been justified in doing so, given what you have done to this world. Seb was crushing my hand. I was aware of a faint ringing in my ears. This was ridiculous. A bad joke. Or brain plague. Yes, it must be brain plague. Sion was trying to make us think we'd gone insane. Maybe we had. But we had mercy. We took pity. We negotiated with your rulers, starting on this small island. They gave us this city, which we named Sheol One, and sent us a certain number of clairvoyants each decade. Our primary source was, and remains, the capital city of London. It was this city that worked for 7 decades to develop the Sion security system. Sion has greatly increased the chance of clairvoyance being recognized, relocated, and rehabilitated into a new society, away from so-called Amarotics. In exchange for that service, we have vowed not to destroy your world. Instead, we plan to take control of it. I wasn't certain that I understood what she was saying, but one thing was clear. If she was telling the truth, Sion was no more than a puppet government, subordinate, and it had sold us out. It didn't really come as a surprise. The girl in the row behind couldn't stand it any longer. With a choked scream, she made a break for the door. She didn't stand a chance against the bullet. Screams erupted everywhere. So did the blood. Seb's nails dug into my hand. In the chaos, one of the Rephaim stepped forward. Silence! The noise stopped at once. Blood flowered under the girl's hair. Her eyes were open. Her expression lingered, distraught, terrified. The killer was human, wearing red. He holstered his revolver and put his hands behind his back. Two of his companions, both girls, took the body by the arms and dragged it outside. Always one yellow jacket, one said, loud enough for everyone to hear. The marble floor was stained. Nashira looked at us with no hint of emotion. If any more of you would like to run, now is the time to do so. Be assured, we can make room in the grave. Nobody moved. In the silence that followed, I risked a glance at the plinths. One of the Rafaim was looking at me. He must have been examining me for some time. His gaze cleaved straight to mine, as if he'd been waiting for me to look, watching for a flicker of dissent. His skin was a dark honey gold, setting off two heavy-lidded yellow eyes. He was the tallest of the five males, with coarse brown hair, clothed in embroidered black. Wrapped around him was a strange, soft aura, overshadowed by the others in the room. He was the single most beautiful and terrible thing I'd ever laid eyes on. A spasm tore through my insides. I snapped my gaze back to the floor. Would they shoot me just for looking? Nashira was still speaking, pacing up and down the rows. Clairvoyants have developed great strength over the years. You are used to survival. The mere fact that you are standing here, having evaded capture for so long, is a testimony to your collective ability to adapt. Your gifts have proven invaluable in keeping the Amim at bay. This is why, over 10 years, we collect as many of you as possible, keeping you in the tower to await your transition from Sion. We call these decadal harvests bone seasons. This is bone season 20. You will be given identification numbers in due course. Those of you who are clairvoyant will now be assigned a Rafait Keeper. She indicated her companions. Your keeper is your master in all things. He or she will test your abilities and assess your value. If any of you show cowardice, you will be given the yellow tunic, that of a coward. Those of you who are amaurotic, that is, the few of you who have no idea what I'm talking about, she added, will be put to work in our residences, to serve us. Zeb didn't appear to be breathing. If you do not pass your first test, or if you earn the yellow tunic twice, you will be placed under the care of the overseer, who will mold you into a performer. Performers are there for our entertainment, and the entertainment of those in our employ. I wondered at the choice. Circus freak or conscription? My lips shook and my free hand balled into a fist. I had imagined many reasons for voyance being taken, but nothing like this. Human trafficking. No, voyant trafficking. Sion had sent us into slavery. A few people were weeping now. Others stood in rapt horror. Nashira didn't seem to notice. She hadn't even blinked when the girl died. She hadn't blinked at all. Rafaim, do not forgive. Those of you who adapt to the system will be rewarded. Those who do not will be punished. None of us want that to happen, but should you show us disrespect, you will suffer. This is your life now. Seb fainted. Julian and I propped him up between us, but he was still a dead weight. The 9 Rafaim stepped down from their plinths. I kept my head down. These Rafaim have offered their services as keepers, Nashira informed us. They will decide which of you they wish to take. 7 of the 9 began to walk around the room, between the rows. The last one, the one I'd looked at, stayed with Nashira. I didn't dare look at Julian, but I said in a whisper, "It can't be true." "Look at them." He barely moved his lips. Our proximity on either side of Seb was all that allowed me to hear him. "They're not human. They're from somewhere else." "You mean this netherworld?" I shut my mouth when a ref passed, then continued. "The only other dimension is the ether. That's it. The ether exists alongside meat space, around us, not outside of us. This is something more." A frantic laugh bubbled up inside me. "Science gone mad." Julian didn't answer. Across the room, a Rafait took Carl by the elbow. 2059-1, she said. "I lay claim to you." Carl swallowed as he was led to a plinth, but he kept up his brave face. Once he was deposited, the Rephaim returned to their circling, like flimps sizing up a wealthy target. I wondered how they were choosing us. Was it bad for Carl to have been chosen so soon? Minutes ticked by. The rows dwindled. The Whisperer, now 2059 too, joined Carl. The Oracle went with Pleione, seemingly uninterested by the procedure. A cruel-faced male dragged the palmist to his plinth. She started to cry, gasping, "Please," over and over to no avail. Soon Julian was taken. 2059-26. He shot me a look, nodded, and went with his new keeper to the plinths. 12 more names were changed to numbers. They got to 38. Finally, there were 8 of us left. The 6 Amarotics, a Jilker, and me. Someone had to choose me. Several of the Rephaim had examined me, paying close attention to my body and my eyes, but none had claimed me. What would happen if I wasn't chosen? The Jilker, a small boy with cornrows, was led away by Pleione. 39. Now I was the only Voyant left. The Rephaim looked to Nishira. She looked at those of us who remained. My spine pulled tight as rope. Then the one that had watched me step forward. He didn't speak, but he drew closer to Nishira, and his head tilted towards me. Her eyes flicked to my face. She raised a hand and crooked a long finger. Like Pleione, she wore black gloves. All of them did. Seb was still unconscious. I tried to let him slide to the floor, but he clung. Noticing my predicament, one of the Amarotic men took him from my arms. Every eye was on me as I walked across the marble floor and stopped in front of the pair. Nishira seemed much taller up close, and the male stood a clear foot above me. "Your name?" "Paige Mahoney." "Where are you from?" "First cohort." "Not originally." "They must have seen my records." "Ireland," I said. A tremor passed through the room. "Sion Belfast?" "No, the free part of Ireland," somebody gasped. "I see. A free spirit, then." Her eyes seemed bioluminescent. "We are intrigued by your aura. Tell me, what are you?" "A cipher," I said. I turned cold under her stare. "I have good news for you, Paige Mahoney." Nishira placed her hand on her companion's arm. "You have attracted the attention of the Blood Consort, Arcturus, Warden of the Mazatim. He has decided to be your keeper." The Rephaim looked at each other. They didn't speak, but their auras seemed to ripple. "It is rare that he takes interest in a human," Nishira said, her voice as quiet as if she were entrusting me with some closely guarded secret. "You are very, very fortunate." I didn't feel fortunate. I was sickened. The Blood Consort leaned down to my level, a long way down. I didn't look away. 2059-40. His voice was deep and soft. "I lay claim to you." So this man was to be my master. I looked right into his eyes, even though I shouldn't. I wanted to know the face of my enemy. The last of the Voyants had been taken from the floor. Nishira raised her voice to the 6 Amarotics. "You 6 will wait here. An escort will be sent to lead you to the barracks. The rest of you will go with your keepers to the residences. Good luck to you all, and remember, the choices you make here are yours alone. I only hope you make the right ones." With that, she turned and walked away. 2 red jackets followed her. I was left to stand with my new keeper, numb. Arcturus moved towards the door. He made a motion with his hand, beckoning me to follow. When I didn't come at once, he stopped and waited. Everyone was looking at me. My head spun. I saw red, then white. I walked out after him. The first stain of dawn had touched the spires. The Voyants came out after their keepers, 3 or 4 to each group. I was the only one with an individual keeper, Arcturus came to stand beside me. Too close. My back stiffened. You should know that we sleep by day here. I said nothing. You should also know that it is not my custom to take tenants. What a nice word for prisoners. If you pass your tests, you will live with me on a permanent basis. If you do not, I will be forced to evict you. And the streets here are not kind. I still said nothing. I knew that streets weren't kind. They couldn't be much worse than they were in London. You are not mute, he said. Speak. I didn't know I was allowed to speak without permission. I will allow you that privilege. There's nothing to say. Arcturus examined me. His eyes held a dead heat. We are stationed at the residence of Magdalen. He turned his back from the dawn. I take it you are strong enough to walk, girl. I can walk, I said. Good. So we walked. We walked out of the building and onto the street, where the sinister performance had come to an end. I spotted the contortionist near the stage, feeding her silks into a bag. She met my eyes, then looked away. She had the delicate aura of a cartomancer, and the bruises of a prisoner. Magdalen was a magnificent building. It was from a different age, a different world. It had a chapel and bell towers, and high glass windows that burned with a ferocious light of torches. A bell clanged out 5 chimes as we approached and went through a small door. A boy in a red tunic bowed when we passed a series of cloisters. I followed Arcturus into the gloom. He went up a winding stone staircase and stopped before a heavy door, which he unlocked with a small brass key. In here, he said to me. This will be your new home. The Founder's Tower. I looked into my prison. Behind the door was a large rectangular room. The furnishings were nothing short of opulent. The walls were white, devoid of clutter. All that hung on them was a crest, topped with 3 flowers, and a black and white pattern beneath them. A slanted chessboard. Heavy red curtains fell on either side of the windows, which looked out over courtyards. 2 armchairs faced a magnificent wood-burning fireplace. And a red daybed sat in the corner, piled with silk cushions. Beside it, a grandfather clock stood against the wall. A gramophone played Gloomy Sunday from a dark wood writing table, and there was an elegant nightstand beside the lavish 4-poster bed. Beneath my feet was a richly patterned carpet. Arcturus locked the door. I watched him tuck the key away. I have little knowledge of humans. You may have to remind me of your needs. He tapped his finger on the table. In here are the medicinal substances. You are to take 1 of each pill every night. I didn't speak, but I skimmed his dreamscape. Ancient and strange, indurated by time. A magic lantern in the ether. The stranger in 4 had most definitely been one of them. I sensed his eyes reading beyond my face, studying my aura, trying to work out what he'd saddled himself with. Or what buried treasure he'd uncovered. The thought brought on another surge of hatred. Look at me. It was an order. I raised my chin, met his gaze. I'd be damned if I let him see the fear he stirred in me. You do not have the spirit sight, he observed. That will be a disadvantage here. Unless you have some means of compensating, of course. Perhaps a stronger 6th sense. I didn't answer. It had always been my dream to be at least half-sighted, but I remained spirit-blind. I couldn't see the ether's little lights. I could only ever sense them. Jackson had never thought it a weakness. Do you have any questions? His unpitying eyes searched every inch of my face. Where do I sleep? I will have a room prepared for you. For now you will sleep here. He indicated the daybed. Anything else? No. I will be away tomorrow. You may acquaint yourself with the city in my absence. You will be back by dawn every day. You will return to this room at once if you hear the siren. If you steal or touch or otherwise meddle with anything, I will know. Yes, sir. The sir just slipped out. Take this. He held out a capsule. Take a second tomorrow night, along with the others. I didn't take it.
Arcturus poured a glass of water from the decanter, not looking at me. He handed me the glass and the capsule. I wet my lips.
What if I don't take it?
There was a long silence.
It was an order, he said, not a request.
My heart palpitated. I rolled it between my fingers. It was olive in color, tinged with gray. I swallowed it. It tasted bitter. He took the glass.
One more thing.
Arcturus grasped the back of my head in his free hand, turning it to face him. A cold tremor rolled down my spine. You will address me only by my ceremonial title, Warden. Is that understood?
Yes.
I forced myself to say it. He looked right into my eyes, burning his message into my skull before he loosened his hand. We will begin your training upon my return. He made for the door. Sleep well. I couldn't help it. I laughed a low, bitter laugh. He half turned his head. I watched his eyes empty. Without another word, he left. The key turned in the lock. Chapter 5. The Indifferent. A red sun glinted through the window. The light roused me from a deep sleep. There was a bad taste in my mouth. For a moment I thought I was back in my bedroom in First Five, away from Jax, away from work. Then I remembered. Bone seasons, refame, a gunshot and a body. I was definitely not in First Five. The cushions lay on the floor, cast off in the night. I sat up to assess my surroundings, rubbing my stiff neck. The small of my back ached and my head pounded. One of my hangovers, as Nick called them. Arcturus, Warden, was nowhere to be seen. The gramophone was still sorrowing away. I recognized Sanson's Danse Macabre immediately, and with alarm. Jax listened to it when he was particularly cantankerous, usually over a glass of vintage wine. It had always given me the creeps. I switched it off, pushed the drapes from the window, and looked down at the east-facing courtyard. There was a refait guard positioned by a pair of giant oak doors. A fresh uniform had been laid out on the bed. I found a note on the pillow, written in a bold black cursive. Wait for the bell. I thought back to the oration. Nobody had mentioned a bell. I scrunched the note into my hand and tossed it into the hearth, where other scraps were waiting to be burned. I spent a few minutes scouring the room, checking every corner. There were no bars in these windows, but they couldn't be opened. The walls hid no secret seams or sliding panels. There were two more doors, one of which was hidden behind thick red drapes, and locked. The other led to a large bathroom. Finding no light switch, I took one of the oil lamps inside. The bath was the same black marble as the library floor, surrounded by diaphanous curtains. A gilded mirror took up most of one wall. I approached this first, curious to see if the mutilation of my life showed in my face. It didn't. Save for the cut lip, I looked just the same as I had before they caught me. I sat in the darkness, thinking. The Refaim had struck their deal in 1859, exactly 2 centuries ago. That was Lord Palmerston's time in office, if I remembered my classes correctly. It was long before the end of the monarchy in 1901, when a new Republic of England took power and declared war on unnaturalness. That republic had taken the country through nearly 3 decades of indoctrination and propaganda, before it was named Sion in 1929. That was when the first Inquisitor was chosen, and London became the first Sion citadel. All this suggested to me that somehow the Refaim's arrival had triggered Sion. All that bullshit about unnaturalness, just to save these creatures that had come from nowhere. I took a deep breath. There must be more to this, there must be. Somehow I would understand. My first priority was to get out of here. Until I could do that, I would search this place for answers. I couldn't just walk away. Not now I knew where Voynes were being sent. I couldn't forget all I'd heard and seen. First I would find Seb. His amaurosis made him ignorant and scared, But he was only a kid. He didn't deserve this. Once I located him, I'd find Julian and the other detainees from Bone Season 20. I wanted to know more about the Imim, and until my keeper got back, they were my only source of information. A bell rang in the tower outside, echoed by another louder chime in the distance. Wait for the bell. There must be a curfew. I placed the lamp on the edge of the bath. As I splashed my face with cold water, I considered my options. It was best to play along with her fame for now. If I survived long enough, I would try and contact Jax. Jax would come for me. He never left a Voyant behind. Not a Voyant he employed, anyway. I'd seen him leave Buskers to die more than once. It was getting darker in the chamber. I pulled open the middle drawer of the writing table. Inside were three blister packs of pills. I didn't want to take them, but I had a feeling he might count them to make sure I did. Unless I just threw them away. I popped out one from each packet, red, white, and green. None of them were labeled. The city was full of non-humans, full of things I didn't yet understand. These pills might be there to protect me from something. Toxins, radiation, the contamination sign had warned us about. Maybe it wasn't a lie. Maybe I should take them. I would have to in the end when he came back. But he wasn't here now. He couldn't see me. I washed all three pills down the sink. He could take his medicine and choke. When I tried the door, I found it unlocked. I descended the stone steps back into the cloisters. This residence was enormous. At the door to the street, a bony girl with a pink nose and dirty blonde hair had replaced the boy in the red. She looked up from a counter when I approached. "Hello," she said. "You must be new." "Yes." "Well, you've started your journey in a great place. Welcome to Maudlin, the best residence in Sheol One. I'm 1949-33, the night porter. How can I help you?" "You can let me go outside." "Do you have permission?" "I don't know." I didn't care either. "Okay, I'll check for you." Her smile was getting tense. "Can I take your number?" 205940. The girl consulted her ledger. When she found the right page, she looked up at me with wide eyes. "You're the one the warden took in." Well, took in was one way of putting it. "He's never taken a human tenant before," she continued. "Not many of them do at Maudlin. Mostly it's just refs with a few human assistants. You're very lucky to be lodging with him, you know." "So I've been told," I said. "I have a few questions about this place, if you don't mind."
"Go ahead."
"Where do I get food?" "The warden left a note about that." She poured a handful of blunted needles, cheap tin rings and thimbles into my palm. "Here, they're Numa. The Harleys always need them. You can exchange them for food in the stalls outside. There's a sort of squatter settlement, you know, but it's not very good. I'd wait for your keeper to feed you."
"Is he likely to do that?"
"Maybe."
"Well, now that was cleared up. Where is the settlement?" I said.
"On the Broad. Take the first right out of Maudlin, then the first left. You'll see it." She turned to a new page in her ledger. "Remember, you mustn't sit down in public areas without permission, or enter any of the residences. Don't wear anything apart from your uniform either. Oh, and you absolutely must be back here by dawn."
"Why?"
"Well, the refs sleep by day. I assume you know that spirits are easier to see when the sun goes down. And that makes training easier."
"Exactly."
I really didn't like this girl.
"Do you have a keeper?"
"Yes, I do. He's away at the moment, you know."
"Away where?"
"I don't know, but I'm sure it's for something important."
"I see.
Thanks."
"You're welcome. Have a nice night."
"And remember," she added, "don't go beyond the bridge." Well, someone was brainwashed. I smiled and took my leave. As I left the residence, my breath already clouding, I began to wonder what I'd got myself into. The warden. His name was whispered like a prayer, like a promise. Why was this one different from the others? What did blood consort mean?
I promised myself I would look into it later. For now I would eat. Then I would find Seb. At least I had somewhere to sleep when I returned. He might not have been so lucky. A thin fog had descended. There seemed to be no electricity in the city. To my left was a stone bridge, set on both sides with gas lamps. This must be the bridge I couldn't cross. A line of red-clad guards blocked the route between the city and the outside world. When I didn't move, all 10 of them pointed their guns at me. Cyan weapons, military grade. With all 10 sights trained on my back, I set off to find the little town. The street ran alongside Maudlin's grounds, separated from the residence by a high wall. I passed 3 heavy wooden doors, each guarded by a human in a red tunic. The wall was topped with iron spikes. I kept my head down and followed 33's directions. The next street was just as deserted as the first, with no gas lamps to light my way. When I emerged from the darkness, my hands raw with cold, I found myself in something like a city center. 2 large buildings towered on the left. The nearest had pillars and a decorated pediment, like the Grand Museum in First Cohort. I walked past it, onto the broad. Tea lights shone on every step and ledge. The sound of human life strained through the night. Rickety stalls and food booths had been constructed down the center of the street, lit by dirty lanterns. They were skeletal and gloomy. On either side of them were rows of rudimentary huts, shacks, and tents, made of corrugated metal and plywood and plastic. A shanty town in the center of a city. And the siren. An old mechanical model with a single gaping horn. Not like the hive-like electrical clusters on NVD outposts. Designed for use in a national emergency. I hoped I'd never hear the sound that swelled up from its rotors. The last thing I needed was some flesh-eating killing machine on my tail. The smell of roasting meat drew me towards the shanty town. My stomach was tight with hunger. I walked into a dark, close tunnel, following my nose. The shacks seemed to be linked by a series of plywood tunnels, patched up with bits of scrap metal and cloth. They had few windows. Instead, they were lit by candles and paraffin lamps. I was the only person in a white tunic. These people all wore filthy clothes. The colors did little for their sallow complexions, their lifeless bloodshot eyes. None of them looked healthy. These must be the performers. Humans who had failed their tests and been condemned to amuse the refame for the rest of their lives, and probably their afterlives. Most were soothsayers or augurs, the most common kinds of voyant. A few people glanced at me, but they soon moved on. It was like they didn't want to look for too long. The source of the smell was a large square room with a hole cut into the corrugated metal roof to let out smoke and steam. I sat down in a dark corner, trying not to draw attention to myself. The meat was being served in wafer-thin slices, still pink and tender in the middle. The performers passed around plates of meat and vegetables and scooped cream from silver tureens. People were fighting over the food, stuffing it into their mouths, licking the hot juices from their fingers. Before I could ask, a voyant pressed a plate into my hands. He was scrawny, dressed in little more than rags. His thick glasses were scratched all over. "Is Mayfield still in the starch?" I raised an eyebrow. "Mayfield?" "Yes, Abel Mayfield." He sounded it out in syllables. "Is he still in the Arkan? Is he still Grand Inquisitor?" "Mayfield died years ago." "Who is it now?" "Frank Weaver." "All right. You haven't got a copy of The Descendant, have you?" "They confiscated everything." I glanced around for somewhere to sit down. "Did you really think Mayfield was still the Inquisitor?" It was impossible not to know the Inquisitor's identity. Scarlet Burnish excluded, Weaver was the heart and soul of Cyan. "All right, don't get in your high horse. How was I supposed to know? We only get news once a decade." He grabbed my arm, leading me to a corner. "Did they ever bring back the Roaring Boy?" "No." I tried to free my arm, but he clung. "Is Sinatra still blacklisted?" "Yes." "Shame. What about the Flea Pit? Did they ever find it?" "Cyril, she's just arrived. I think she'd like something to eat." someone had noticed my predicament. Cyril rounded on the speaker, a young woman with her arms crossed and her chin tipped up.
You are an absolute stinking bloody curmudgeon, Rymal. Did you pick up the tin of swords again today?
Yeah, when I was thinking about you. With a glower, Cyril snatched the plate and scarpered. I made a grab for his shirt, but he was faster than a flimp. The girl shook her head. She had small, quick features, framed by matted black ringlets. Her red lipstick stood out like a fresh wound against her skin.
You had your oration last night, little sister.
Her voice carried a burr.
Your stomach wouldn't have taken it.
I ate yesterday morning, I said. I wasn't sure whether to laugh at being called little sister by this tiny girl.
Trust me, it's a flux. It's jenked your brain.
She glanced around the room.
Quick, come with me.
Where?
I have a crib, we can talk.
I didn't much like the idea of following a stranger, but I had to talk to someone. I went after her. My guide seemed to know everyone. She touched hands with various people, always keeping an eye on me to make sure I was still behind her. Her clothes appeared to be in better condition than those of the other performers. A flimsy bell-sleeved shirt, trousers too short for her legs.
She must be freezing.
She drew back a ragged curtain.
Quick, she said again. They'll see.
It was dim beyond the curtain, but a paraffin stove kept the shadows at bay. I sat down. A pile of stained sheets and a cushion made a rudimentary bed. Do you always take in strays?
Sometimes.
I know how it is when you arrive. The girl sat down by the stove.
Welcome to the family.
I'm part of a family.
You are now, sister.
And it's not the cold kind of family, if that's what you're thinking. Just a family form for protection. Her fingers worked at the stove.
I'm guessing you came from the syndicate?
Maybe. I didn't. The Centrals didn't need my sort. A faint smile touched her lips.
I came here during the last bone season.
How long ago was that?
10 years. I was 13.
She extended a calloused hand. After a moment, I shook it.
Liz Rymore.
Page.
2059-40?
Yes. Liz caught my expression.
Sorry, she said.
Force of habit.
Or maybe I'm brainwashed.
I shrugged. What number are you?
1949-1.
How do you know mine?
She poured a little methylated spirit into the stove. News travels fast in a city this small. We can't get any word from outside. They don't like us to know what's going on out there in the free world. If you call Cyan free.
A blue flame leapt up. Your number is on everyone's lips.
Why?
Didn't you hear? Arcturus Mazartum has never taken a human to his residence. He's never shown interest in humans at all, in fact. It's big news here, sad to say. Happens when you can't get the penny papers.
Do you know why he chose me?
My best guess is that Nashir has got her lamps on you. He's the blood consort, her fiancé. We stay out of his way. Not that he ever leaves that tower.
She attached a billy can onto the stove.
Let me get you something to eat before we talk.
Sorry, it's been years since we've eaten at tables, us Harleys.
Harleys?
It's what jackets call the performers. They don't like us much.
She heated up some broth and poured it into a bowl. I offered her a few rings, but she shook her head.
On the house.
I took a sip of the broth. It was odorless and translucent, and it tasted vile. But it was warm. Liz watched as I scraped the bowl clean.
Here.
She passed me a hunk of stale bread. Skilly and toke.
You'll get used to it.
Most of the keepers conveniently forget that we need to eat on a regular basis.
There's meat in there. I gestured to the central room.
That's just to celebrate bone season 20. I made this skilly from the juices earlier.
She poured herself a bowl.
We rely on the rotis to keep us from starving. This junk is all from the kitchens, she said, nodding to the stove and billy can. They're only meant to cook for red jackets, but they sneak us food when they can.
Having said that, they've been less willing to help us since one of the girls was caught. What happened?
The Rotti got beaten. The Voyant she was feeding got 4 days of sleep dep. He was raving by the time they let him out.
Sleep deprivation. It was a novel punishment. Voyant minds functioned on 2 levels, life and death. It was tiring. Being kept awake for 4 days would drive a Voyant mad.
Who brings the food into the city?
No idea. Maybe the train. It runs from London to Sheol 1. Nobody knows where the entrances to the tunnel are, obviously. She shifted her feet closer to the stove.
How long did you think the brain plague lasted?
Forever. It was 5 days. They let the rookies go through hell for 5 days before they give them the antidote.
Why?
So they learn their place as quickly as possible.
You're no more than a number here unless you earn your colours.
Liz helped herself to a bowl of broth.
So you're at Magdalen?
Yes.
You're probably sick of hearing this, but consider yourself lucky. Magdalen is one of the safest residences for a human.
How many are there?
Humans?
Residences.
Oh, right. Well, each residence is a small district. There are 7 for humans. Balliol, Corpus, Exeter, Merton, Oriel, Queens, and Trinity. Nishira lives at the residence of the suzerain, where you had your oration. Then there's the house, a little way south, and the castle, the detainment facility, and this dump, the rookery. The street is called the Broad, the street that runs parallel as Magdalen Walk.
And beyond that?
Deserted countryside. We call it no man's land. It's rigged with mines and trap pits.
Has anyone ever tried to cross it?
Yes. Her shoulders were tense. I took another sip of skilly.
How was the tower?
I looked up at her.
I didn't go to the tower.
Were you born in a boon or something?
When I frowned, Liz shook her head. They collect Voyants for each bone season over 10 years. Some of them are in the tower for a decade before they get posted here.
You're kidding. That explained the Persap that had been there for 9 years.
Nope. They're pretty cocoon when it comes to keeping us tame. They know all our weak points, how to break us. 10 years in the tower would break anyone.
What are they?
No idea. Except they're not human. She dabbed some bread in the skilly.
They act like gods. That's how they'd like to be treated.
And we're their worshippers.
Not just their worshippers.
We owe them our lives.
They never let us forget they're protecting us from the buzzers, and that slavery is for our own good.
We'd rather be slaves than dead, they say.
Or victimized outside by the Inquisitor.
Buzzers?
The Imim. That's what we call them.
Why?
We've always called them that. I think the Red Jackets came up with it.
They're the ones that have to fight them off.
How often?
Depends on the time of year. They attack a lot more in winter.
Listen out for the siren. A single blast summons the Red Jackets. If the tone starts to change, get inside. It means they're coming.
I still don't understand what they are.
I tore up some bread.
Are they anything like the Rafaim?
I've heard stories. The Red Jackets like scaring us. The firelight played across her face.
They say the Imim take on different forms. Just being near them can kill you. Some say they can rip your spirit straight out of your body. Some call them rotting giants, whatever that means. Others say they're walking bones that need skin to cover themselves.
I don't know how much of it's true, but they definitely eat human flesh.
They're addicted to it.
Don't be surprised if you see a few missing limbs out there.
I should have been sickened.
Instead, I was numb.
It just didn't seem real.
Liz reached over to adjust the curtain, concealing us from the people outside. A stack of coloured silk caught my eye.
You're the contortionist, I said.
Did you think I was good?
Very good.
That's how I earn my flatches here.
Lucky for me, I picked it up quickly. Used to busk near the Penny Gaff.
She licked her lips clean.
I saw you with Pliny last night.
Your aura was a talking point.
I didn't say anything. It was dangerous to talk about my aura, especially when I'd only just met this girl. Liz studied me. Are you sighted? No. That was true. What were you arrested for? I killed someone. An underguard. True. How? Knife, I said. Heat of the moment. False. Liz looked at me for a long time. She was full-sighted, typical of soothsayers. She could see my red aura as clearly as my face. If she'd read up on the subject, she'd know which category I fell into. I don't think so. Her fingers drummed on the floor. You never spilled that much blood. She was good. For a soothsayer. You're not an oracle, she stated, more to herself than to me. I've seen oracles. You're too calm to be a fury, and you're definitely not a medium. So you must be... Recognition dawned in her eyes. A dreamwalker? Her gaze returned to mine. Are you? I held her eye contact. Liz sat back on her heels. Well, that solves it. What? Why Arcturus took you on? Nishida has never found a walker, and she really wants one. She'll want to make sure you're protected. Nobody will touch you if you're as human. If she thinks there's the slightest chance you might be a walker, she'll do you right down. How so? You won't like this. I doubted anything could surprise me now. Nishida has a gift, Liz said. Did you notice that weird aura coming off her? I nodded. She doesn't just have one ability. She walks several different paths to the ether. That's impossible. We all have one gift. You know reality? Forget it. Sheol One has its own rules. Accept that now and everything will be easier. She pulled her battered knees up to her chin. Nishida has 5 guardian angels. Somehow she gets them to stay with her. Is she a binder? We don't know. She must have been a binder once, but her aura's been corrupted. By what? By the angels. When I frowned, she sighed. This is just a theory. We think she can use the gifts they had when they were alive. Not even binders can do that. Exactly. She glanced at me. If you want my advice, you'll keep your head down. Give no inkling of what you are. If she finds out you're a walker, you're bones. I kept my expression neutral. 3 years in the Syndicate had inured me to danger, but this place was different. I would have to learn to duck new threats. How do I stop her finding out? It'll be hard. They'll test you to expose your gift. That's what the tunics mean. Pink after your first test, red after the second. But you failed your tests. Luckily. Now I answer to the overseer. Who was your keeper? Liz looked back at the stove. Gomesa Sargas. Who's he? The other blood sovereign. There are always 2, a male and a female. But Arcturus is betrothed to Nishira, yes. But he's not of the blood, she said with a note of disgust. Only the Sargas family can take the crown. The blood sovereigns can't be a mated pair. That would be incestuous. Arcturus is from a different family. So he's the prince consort. Blood consort. Same thing. More skilly? I'm fine, thanks. I watched her drop the bowl into a tub of greasy water. How did you fail your tests? I stayed human. She offered a small smile. Refs aren't human. No matter how much they look like us, they're not like us. They've got nothing here. Her finger tapped her chest. If they want us to work with them, they have to get rid of our souls. How? Before she could answer, the curtain was torn back. A lean male Rafate stood in the doorway. You, he snarled at Liz. Her hands flew to her head. Get up. Get dressed, lazy filth. And with a guest? Are you a queen? Liz stood. All her strength was gone, leaving her small and fragile. Her left hand shook. I'm sorry, Sewell, she said. Forty is new here. I wanted to explain the rules of Sheol One.
Forty should already know the rules of Sheol One.
Forgive me.
He raised his gloved hand as if to strike her. Get onto the silks.
I didn't think I was performing tonight. She backed into the corner of the shack. Have you talked to the overseer? I took a good look at her interrogator. He was tall and golden, like the other Rafaim, but he didn't have that blank stare the others favored. Every crease of his face was loaded with hatred. I do not need to speak with the overseer, little pull-string puppet. 15 remains indisposed. The Red Jackets expect their favorite fool to replace him. His lips drew back over his teeth. Unless you wish to join him in the detainment facility, you will perform in 10 minutes. Liz flinched. Her shoulders pulled towards her chest and she looked away. I understand, she said. There's a good slave. He ripped the curtain down on his way out. I helped Liz gather it up. She was shaking, physically shaking. Who was that? Sewell Curtin. The overseer's always a bit tense under all that grease paint. He answers to Sewell if we do something wrong. She dabbed her eyes with her sleeve. 15 is the one that got sleep dip. Jordan, he's the other contortionist. I took the curtain from her hands. Her sleeve was dark with blood. You cut yourself? It's nothing. No, it's not. Blood was never nothing. It's okay. She wiped her face, leaving red smears below her eyes. He just took a bit of my glow. He what? He fed on me. I was sure I'd misheard her. He fed on you? I repeated. Liz smiled. Did they forget to mention that refs feed on aura? That always slips their mind. Her face was streaked with blood. My stomach clenched. That's impossible. Aura doesn't sustain life, I said. It sustains buoyance, not... It sustains their life. But that would mean they weren't just clairvoyant. They would have to be the ether incarnate. Maybe they are. Liz pulled a threadbare blanket around her shoulders. That's what we Harleys are here for. We're just aura machines, wraith fodder. But you Jackets, you don't get fed on. That's your privilege. She looked at the stove. Unless you fail your tests. I was silent for a while. The idea that the Rafaim fed on aura just didn't compute. It was a link to the ether, unique to each buoyant. I couldn't imagine how they could use it for survival. But the news was like a light on Sheol One. That was why they took buoyants into their fold. That was why the performers weren't bumped off if they couldn't fight the Imim. They didn't just want them to dance. Why should they? Those were asinine distractions, to stop them getting bored with all their power. We weren't only their slaves, we were their food source. That was why we were paying for human error, not the Amarotics. And to think I'd been in London a few days before this, living my life in Seven Dials, not knowing that this colony existed. Someone has to stop them, I said. This is insane. They've been here for 200 years. Don't you think someone would have stopped them by now? I turned away, my head pounding. I'm sorry. Liz glanced at me. I don't want to scare you, but I've been here 10 years. I've seen people fight, people who wanted to go back to their old lives, and have all wound up dead. In the end, you'll just stop trying. Are you a seer? I knew she wasn't, but I wondered if she'd lie. Broadsider. It was an old word for a cartomancer, street slang of a decade past. The very first time I read the cards, they knew. What did you see? For a minute, I thought she hadn't heard me. Then she crossed the shack and knelt beside a small wooden box. She took out a deck of tarot cards, tied with a red ribbon, and handed one to me. The Fool. I always knew I was destined to be the bottom of the pile, she said. I was right. Can you read mine? Another time. You have to go. Liz took a cake of rosin from the chest. Come and see me again soon, sister. I can't protect you, but I've been here a decade. I might be able to stop you getting yourself